This is KSL's Religion Today, a weekly look at religion and spirituality here at home and around the world. Now, here's your host, Martin Tanner, on KSL News Radio.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. In the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it's often said that everything can be traced back to either the translation of the Book of Mormon or the First Vision. In truth, it's kind of both, because the First Vision, although not often noticed, had as one of Joseph Smith's descriptions of it the comment that many angels also visited him during that first vision. Apparently, some of those angels visited Joseph Smith, not just about the restoration, but about the translation of the Book of Mormon. So the first vision actually relates to the translation of the Book of Mormon. It also relates to the restoration of the gospel, which is extremely involved with or almost springs from the translation of the Book of Mormon. When Joseph Smith was translating the Book of Mormon, one of the things that he understood over and over again was that the Bible was either not complete or, as is said in the Book of Mormon many times, many plain and precious things that were part of it had been lost. And so, shortly after the Book of Mormon was translated, one of the most significant undertakings that Joseph Smith was involved in was the translation or inspired revision of what we call the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible, or the inspired version of the Bible. How did it come about? Well, it came about actually during the translation of the Book of Mormon, at least as an idea, but it came about starting right after the translation of the Book of Mormon, which wrapped up in 1829. In the summer of 1830, just a few months after the Book of Mormon was finished, Joseph Smith began a new translation of the Bible, or an inspired revision of it, as I prefer, to restore some of these plain and precious things that had been lost. The Joseph Smith translation wasn't carried out in the traditional sense. He didn't really look at Greek and Hebrew texts or early texts. What he did use is a King James Version of the Bible as a starting point. And we know that because he purchased it from the Grandin store and printing shop. This is the same Grandin that published and printed the Book of Mormon. And Grandin had this beautiful King James Bible, and that's the one that was purchased and used by Joseph Smith as he poured through the King James translation, making a number of changes in it. Joseph worked diligently on this revision or translation from the summer of 1830 until July of 1833. He considered this project to be not just an interesting endeavor, but actually a divine mandate from God. What did he do? What was his translation supposed to accomplish? Well, if you were to write down a list of the kinds of changes that you find in the inspired version, it's really interesting what you get. They fall into several categories. And if you look at these categories that they fall into, they're like this. First of all, long editions that really don't have any biblical parallel. For example, the visions of Moses and of Enoch, the passages on Melchizedek. This isn't simply a slight revising of existing material. This is great new additions of new material. So that would be category number one. Another category of ways that the Bible was changed by Joseph Smith would be clarifications. For example, in Genesis 6:6 in the King James Bible, it says that it repented the Lord that he had made man. And that's revised in Moses chapter 8, verse 25. Moses, of course, is part of the revised translation of the Bible or part of the inspired version. Joseph Smith changed that to saying it repented Noah that God had created man and his heart was pained that the Lord had made man. So the idea here is, well, God doesn't need to repent, but people do. The next kind of change we could describe as interpretive additions. You can spot these when you read the inspired version and it goes on and makes some kind of a statement or there's some kind of a phrase. And then you read, or in other words, and then you have this clarification. So as you're going through the inspired version, if you read some phrase and then you get, or in other words, and more comes about, that's one of the changes Joseph Smith made. A fourth category is to harmonize things that seemed to conflict between passages. And one of those might be as an example where Paul has his vision of Jesus on the road to Damascus. And in one point, it talks about him seeing a light, or the others with him seeing a light but not hearing anything. In another place, it says that they heard things but they didn't see anything. Those kinds of, shall we say, mild contradictions are ironed out in the inspired version. Another thing Joseph Smith did, which would be the fifth category, is to make grammatical improvements, little technical clarifications, and to modernize some of the terms. And this is one of the most common things that happened in the revision that Joseph Smith made. The sixth kind is in some ways the most dramatic. I suppose the very most dramatic kinds are the great long additions that I mentioned first, and the sixth category, which is the changes in meaning. And frankly, these are not quite explainable, except for perhaps this is a work in progress. We do know that Joseph Smith went all the way through the King James Bible and made these changes and additions, but we also know that he didn't feel like the project was completely finished. How do we know that? He was working on it, again, going through the entire Bible, clear up until the time that he was killed in June 1844. This was not an endeavor that was completely finished, which is fascinating, because today, if you look at what is the consensus about the inspired version of the Bible, we set it in some ways above the actual translation of the Bible that we have now. In other words, if you go to a class and somebody reads some passage, then everybody else wants to say, well, that may be true, but the inspired version says such and such, meaning that the inspired version is perhaps even more important. That's the way many Latter-day Saints view it. But query, should they do that? Should they see it that way if it was a work in progress and not something that had been completed? I think we should use at least a little bit of caution there. When we come back, more about the inspired version or the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible. If you have a question or comment about this show, send me an email. Send it to martinstanner@gmail.com. I'll be happy to respond. If you have any kind of religious question, feel free to ask it. If I don't know the answer, I'll do some research or find somebody else who knows the answer. Again, my email is Martin S. Tanner. I'm just about ready to give my phone number out, which I don't want to do. Here's my email. It's martinstanner@gmail.com. martinstanner@gmail.com. We'll be right back.
Religion Today with host Martin Tanner continues on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Martin Tanner. This is the second segment of Religion Today. Our topic for this broadcast is the inspired version of the Bible made by Joseph Smith, sometimes called the Joseph Smith Translation. And the question is, what is this? Was it finished? The answer is that it was not finished, and that this was sort of an inspired revision with many, many additions, and then some corrections, I guess, would be another way to describe much of it. So some of the details that I haven't mentioned yet are that in October of 1829, right after the translation of the Book of Mormon was finished, Oliver Cowdery is the one who purchased from the Grandin store and printing office the King James Bible that Joseph Smith used to translate or to compile or to make inspired changes to the Bible, which we now call the Inspired Version. In June of 1830, Joseph Smith received a revelation that he described as the visions of Moses. And this probably was a catalyst or the underlying inspiration, along with some observations made during the translation of the Book of Mormon, that inspired or prodded Joseph Smith on for his work in connection with the inspired version of the Bible. The earliest manuscripts of the inspired version, beginning with Genesis 1, now called Moses chapter 2, were created in Harmony, Pennsylvania. And about 1 month later, with Oliver Cowdery and John Whitmer acting as scribes, those were completed. A little bit after that, Joseph Smith instructed Emma to serve as Joseph Smith's scribe. She apparently did that for a time. And then in December of that same year, shortly after Sidney Rigdon was baptized in Ohio, he traveled to Fayette, New York, and then he was involved in acting as a scribe. One of the most fascinating things about the time when Sidney Rigdon was involved in acting as a scribe is that this was the time when Joseph Smith was recording or transcribing or dictating the record about the story of Enoch. And this is such a fascinating one because, of course, Enoch or Enoch was a name, a prophet, who's mentioned in Genesis, but there's not much said about him. Joseph Smith, in an inspired manner, dictated much, much more information about Enoch. And the fascinating thing about this is that it parallels, and it's very, very close to some of the early information that was not available to Joseph Smith, but was later available to the world in the late 1800s when the existence of the Book of Enoch was found. There are currently three versions of the Book of Enoch, and these are translated in various different ways. If you decide to go out and get a copy, be forewarned that this is a book that I would describe as full of many inspired things and also full of revisions and additions and changes that makes it, shall we say, not the most reliable book. So be forewarned. The Book of Enoch is, however, fascinating. What did Joseph Smith do with his revisions of the Bible? Well, one of the most fascinating things that he did was receive yet additional revelations about half of the contents of the Doctrine and Covenants is based on or inspired by Joseph Smith's inspired translation or revision of the Bible. Here are just a few examples. Doctrine and Covenants, section 45. The earliest work of the translation focused on Genesis. In March 7th of 1831, what happened is that a revelation changed Joseph's course of action. In the revelation, which is now Doctrine and Covenants section 45, Joseph Smith was instructed to put aside the Old Testament for a while and focus on the New Testament. Section 45 says in part, quote, "I give unto you that ye may now translate it, that ye may be prepared for the things to come, for verily I say unto you that great things await you," close quote. So accordingly, Joseph Smith began the next day to work on the New Testament. They continued on for a time until leaving for Missouri, and the work sort of stalled for a while, and then later on, it was commenced again. Joseph Smith also was, of course, overseeing the church, preaching in the area, and doing many, many other things. In January of 1832, he received another revelation that directed him once again, go back, focus on this work of translating the Bible until it's finished. So this revelation is telling him to finish this project. And it was while he and Sidney Rigdon were working together that on February 16th of 1832, they received what could be described as a landmark revelation while they were at the Johnson home. While working on the translation of the book of John, they inquired, they being Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon, they inquired about significant new doctrines for this new church and what the kingdom of heaven was like. And in response to that, we get sections 77 and 86. So these two sections were inspired by the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible. And what happened there was fascinating because questions arose about the text and what it actually meant and what the kingdom of heaven was like. In December of 1832, W.W. Phelps and Joseph Smith were thinking a lot about what had become Section 76. And Joseph Smith and W.W. Phelps said in a statement that they had finished with the translation of the New Testament and that there were, quote, great and glorious things that had been revealed, close quote, and that they were making rapid strides and that they were continuing to work. Now, notice it says that they had finished the translation of the New Testament. They went back and started working on the Old Testament again. So this is not an indication that they had finished translating everything. Another example of a great impact that came about from the inspired version of the Bible is section 91. Joseph Smith came to a part of the King James Version from which he was working that had the 14 books of the Apocrypha. See, our King James Version doesn't have the Apocrypha today, but it did in the 1800s. And so Joseph Smith scratching his head and saying, well, what do we do with the apocryphal books? And in response, section 91 was given, which in essence says, well, there's a lot of really good stuff there, but it's not important for you to translate it right now. So in conclusion today, what happened to the Joseph Smith translation? The short answer is that it was never finished. When Joseph Smith died, he was still working on it. Emma retained the manuscript of the Joseph Smith translation, and because she and her son, Joseph Smith III, became part of what we would call the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, now the Community of Christ, the inspired translation was possessed by the Community of Christ. Now, in the early part of the 20th century, the Community of Christ and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints became much more cordial, and they worked together on the inspired version in terms of scholarship on it, and that's how it's come to be part of our scriptures today. I'm Martin Tanner. Joining me again next week for Religion Today.